You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
War, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek: The Next Generation. And tonight's episode is A Natural Selection. I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm James from London.
Sorry. Okay. Anyway, how are you, James?
Oh, I'm good. I'm good. Now, Lou, last week you told me that I should watch Cat's Paw as part of my Halloween viewing.
Oh, I forgot.
I don't know if you remember that.
I forgot to do it.
But I did not. I did not forget. So we actually sat down and watched a couple of scary Star Trek episodes as we recorded yesterday. And we were a lot more impressed with the scary TNG episode that we watched rather than the scary TOS episode. Go ahead.
Is that Devil's Due? I wanted to see if I can guess.
No, the kids love Devil's Due, and they've actually seen it before, but we did not watch Devil's Due.
Okay.
We watched a spooky TNG. Please, go ahead and guess.
Okay. I'm thinking of the Borg. That might be a Borg thing, but no, beyond that, I really can't think of a really spooky episode offhand.
Well, maybe it's not as spooky as I think, but we watched Night Terrors.
Oh, yes. Night Terrors.
So that's the one with Eyes in the Dark, One Moon Circles. And people have slated it elsewhere, but we actually really enjoyed it. And the kids thought it was the most fantastic thing they'd seen. And my oldest son, gave it 27 thumbs up.
Ah!
And my youngest gave it 2,000 thumbs up.
That's nice. So
you can see where they get their soft critical to... side from
2,027 thumbs just from two kids. That is great. Yep. Man, you can't top that. Okay, that's cool.
That is not.
What about, I can't think of the name offhand, but I kind of was spooked by the one that Riker is doing a play, and all of a sudden it becomes real life, and he can't figure out what's real and what's not.
Yes, A Frame of Mind.
Frame of Mind. That was pretty spooky too.
That was kind of like a psychological
but
freakish kind of thing. I think not suitable for 6-year-olds.
No, probably not.
But the kids really like the there are a couple of mild scares, I suppose, in Night Terrors where Riker gets out of his bed and there are snakes there.
Yeah,
and they love that. And there's the scene where Crusher's in the she's just checking the dead bodies, and then they all sit up. And that was also they were happy to see that, and they got very spooked.
It was spooky. Yes, you're right.
And even the dream that Troy has, where she's flying up. It's very easy. People kind of think it's it looks bad and it's over the top, but the kids loved it. So I was happy to go along with it yesterday.
Okay, cool. Well, that sounds interesting, and I'll have to make it up to everyone and watch Cat's Paw.
Well, we then watched Cat's Paw, and Cat's Paw is not very good.
Yeah, but... Anyway, okay. They tried for the time. All right, well, anyway, the synopsis for tonight's show, A Natural Selection, is... The Enterprise investigates the deaths of the crew of the USS Lantry, who all died of old age. This is the 7th episode of Season 2 of TNG. First aired on January 30th, 1989. Written by John Mason and Mike Gray, and directed by Paul Finch. Holy crap! No, I'm kidding again. Sorry, Paul Lynch. Let's see, where has Paul been every time I've done that? One was on the putty, and the other I'm not sure. Guest stars for tonight, special guest star is Diana Muldaur as Dr. Pulaski, Patricia Smith as Dr. Sarah Kingsley, and Cole Meany as Miles O'Brien. He's got a name! Mr. O'Brien! Congratulations.
Yes, I was about to say, I think this is the first time that he's mentioned with his name on screen.
Yes, congratulations, you've finally been promoted, you old Irish lad. Okay, and then co-stars J. Patrick McNamara as Captain Taggart, who would like to get Pulaski back at a all possible, and Scott Trost as Ensign. Congratulations, Ensign. Ensign, no name. That doesn't matter. So what do we think about this one? Okay. Couple of things I want to mention first before I give my brief thoughts is James and I never, ever, ever talk about an episode in advance and what we're going to say. When you hear it is when I'm shocked by it or surprised by it, or sometimes we think alike, sometimes we're way different. And then another thing that you may have noticed is that when it comes to doing the intro, who reads the script? It depends on the episode number. James has the even numbers and I have the odd numbered, which falls for today, 07. And then the guests, since we have no guests, the guests would have read the opening script. Having said that, I kind of wish James could have read it today because I may shock you guys tonight. I don't know about James if he's ready for it. I bet you anything he knows exactly what I'm going to say. But this one here, it's about Pulaski. I've bagged on Pulaski for 6 episodes. And this one here, I'm completely doing a reversal. This is what Pulaski should have been from day one. She's got guts. She's got gumption. She's willing to risk her life in the pursuit of science. She's completely plausible, and she's actually, you feel for her when they realize there's nothing they can do and she will die probably within the next 2 or 3 days. So this one here, I absolutely was for Pulaski and loved her performance, Diana's performance today. James, what about you? Shocking?
It's not shocking because I don't think we've ever claimed to hate Pulaski just because she's Pulaski. I mean, we've mentioned before, I think the main problem with Pulaski is how she was written with respect to the Data character. But, okay, maybe I will shock you. I think, if memory serves, and it's been a little while, but I don't think Pulaski gets better than this. I think this episode is really very good for Pulaski. I think it's kind of like her standout. I'm surprised that it was 7 episodes in, because there's mention of, from Picard's perspective, that he wants to assess how the doctor's doing and all of that kind of stuff. So it almost sounds like they probably wanted to have this earlier in the season to introduce the character, maybe. But I think Pulaski does extremely well. I think the story isn't as good as how well Pulaski comes across. But I think this is a solid episode, and given that it's a Pulaski-centric episode, that's relatively high praise from me.
Yeah, I can see that. So this is going to be a very interesting at the end of this show when we give our ratings, because again, we have no idea what the other is going to say. So I got a feeling I will probably shock James this time at the end of the show. So stick on, we'll see. But first, what about a little bit of forum feedback? What do you say?
Absolutely. And I think this week we are reviewing feedback from Elementary Dear Data. And once again, thanks to Furbob, Paul Wright, for popping by and helping on that episode.
Yep.
It seems a while ago now. It seems a long time ago.
It does, doesn't it? Okay. Well, first I'd like to go ahead and just pop this voicemail in. This is from Data Logan, who again will be here in a couple episodes for The Measure of a Man. So we'll be looking forward to that. So go ahead and take a listen to this.
Direct from the database in Bremerton, Washington, it's Data Logan's Data Log.
One is my name. The other is not.
2014, October 12th. This is just going to be a copy of a data log that I did last year for a different podcast, but it covers all the same stuff that I wanted to share with you guys about Elementary Dear Data.
15 August 2013. I wanted to give you guys a little bit of feedback on the episode you did where you reviewed Elementary Dear Data. You mentioned in your review what seems to be an inconsistency in that episode. I mean, you're having an episode that revolves all around how holodeck matter cannot exist outside the holodeck. Moriarty cannot leave the holodeck, and that's important to the story. And yet, in the same episode, it seems like there's a piece of paper that leaves the holodeck. Moriarty writes something down on a piece of holodeck paper, gives it the data, and then he takes it out of the holodeck, and it exists outside the holodeck. So it seems like an inconsistency. Like, you know, the writers messed up on that. Or I guess you could explain it away fairly easily to say, and this has been explained before this way, that small objects like paper and water and apples or something that are created on the holodeck are actually created, like using a replicator and a transporter or something. Whereas other things, like bigger things or, you know, people, are not really created on the holodeck. You know, they're a holographic display overlaid on top of force fields to make it seem like it's real and like you can touch it, but it's not really a person. And so maybe there's a difference. So the real interesting thing about this episode is that the truth is neither of those things. It was not a mistake by the writers, and it was not that simple explanation that the paper is different than the person. No, in fact, what it was is that the fact that the paper could leave the holodeck was actually a significant plot point in the way the original story was written. This is one of those situations where they changed the story during filming and they couldn't go back and refilm, so you have these two different plot points that don't seem to go together. But they did originally. In the original story, when Geordi accidentally creates a sentient Moriarty, you know, by asking for an opponent that could defeat Data, that act caused something to happen in the holodeck. It caused a sentient Moriarty to be created, and also overrode the safeties. You saw that in the episode. But the original concept was that it actually changed the holodeck in such a way that matter could pass from the holodeck out into the real world. And that was a significant plot point. So there was this point in the episode, at least as originally scripted, and maybe even filmed. I don't know how far they got before they decided to change the ending. But there was a point in the episode where the Enterprise characters realized that the paper came out of the holodeck. And they talked about it, like, this is significant. Why is this paper off the holodeck? Because it's never happened before. Although it really, of course, had happened before, because they've done mistakes like that in the previous seasons. But the way the original story was written, it was important. Like, the idea was that holodeck matter can never come off the holodeck, and yet this piece of paper did. This came up in the discussion, and the characters talked about it, and they said, wow, if this paper can leave the holodeck, it actually is possible that Moriarty might be able to leave the holodeck. And that changed the dynamic of the episode, so that when Data returns to the holodeck and he takes Picard with him, Picard and Data at that time, in the original draft of the episode, they know that it might actually be possible for Moriarty to walk off the holodeck. But they don't want him to know that. They're afraid of him. They're afraid of what he might do. And maybe, in a way, they're also afraid of what the implications are for their world and all future holodecks and the ability to create new people and things like that. So it changes the dynamic of the end of the show, whereas, you know, there's still this conversation between Picard and Moriarty where he says, you know, I can't bring you off the holodeck. I'm not going to be able to do that, so I'll put you in storage and we'll try and fix you later. Except in the way that the scene was originally drafted, that was a lie. Picard was lying because he was afraid, or, you know, because he didn't want that to happen. But he actually knew, or at least he suspected, that it might actually be possible. It's an interesting dynamic to think that the characters would actually be afraid of it and be willing to lie. You don't see Picard lying too often. I mean, he has at times when he needs to a villain, and Moriarty was certainly a villain, even though he wasn't the one that originally started out in that program. But eventually, I guess the writers, maybe even after filming, decided that that wasn't such a good way to go. And it's probably a good thing that they decided that. I mean, it did set a bad precedent, the fact that the holodecks could create sentient beings. I mean, that's a bad enough precedent to set. But then to say that the same accidental misspeak that creates a sentient being could also allow your holodeck matter to leave the holodeck, that was a pretty significant change in the dynamic of the show that they didn't want to go to. So they dropped that whole line. So it's just interesting to think what could have happened in that episode, or what that episode could have done to Star Trek. And ultimately, I think the writers made a good choice to not do that. Data out.
Okay. So basically, if I understand the gist of the voicemail, there was a separate plot. Now, it's been a while since I've heard the voicemail, and of course, I'm doing this in post-prep or post-work. Is he trying to say that there was some kind of storyline that would have made it possible for Moriarty to leave the holodeck?
Yes, I mean, that's the gist of what was on the cards, from a production point of view, at least, initially.
Okay. In a sense, and he actually gave that voicemail review to another podcast and was gracious enough to go and send it to us for us to play it. So it makes sense what you're saying, yes, but let's talk about what actually happens in the Next Generation that's actually continuity, I guess you could say, or canon, do they call it? Is that it, the word canon?
Yeah, they use canon as the word.
Okay, so in canon, it actually is said that the holodeck does use replicators to actually replicate minor details on things like paper or snow, which is probably why Wesley Crusher, could actually hit Picard with a snowball outside the holodeck, because it actually can create something as minor as that matter, I guess you could say. A book, same thing. I'm sure publishers might not like that, but yeah, that's what I get. It's still correct that you can get matter outside the holodeck as long as it's a simple matter. Or else, if you eat holographic food inside the holodeck and you walk out, can you imagine it just I don't know, would you be hungry again after you leave? Because all the food's gone. It was never there to begin with. Could you get full on the holodeck from eating?
No, I mean, that is one of the examples that I always give, right? if you did eat something on the holodeck and then you walked out, what exactly have you been eating, or have you not been eating anything at all? But I think it makes sense that they can, yeah, I mean, maybe a lot of this in my mind is kind of, you know, me retrospectively trying to plug the gaps or the things that were not quite explicitly shown in the universe. But I imagine that having a bit of replicated technology in there that would produce small things and produce food and stuff like that. And also, I mean, we were talking about holograms, right? Holograms are just, you know, visual representations and force fields. But when you go into into the living room in Sherlock Holmes's recreation and there's the fire, I assume it's also going to be a warm fire, right? So they're going to be producing heat, and so other kind of touches that make it slightly more real than just the light effects and force fields,
right?
Which would be the holograms.
But here's one thing, now that you just mentioned that I just thought, wait a second, actually it doesn't make any sense anymore. So everything in the holodeck, none of it's replicated, it's all force fields and light. So how did the computer know that it was going to that piece of paper was going to go out of the holodeck? Why would it assume that? So really, the paper should have been a holographic image as well, and as soon as it hit the door, it should have dissolved. Do you think maybe the computer knows? How would it know? If he's heading to the door with the piece of paper, does a computer automatically convert that to replicated material? Actually, there's still a plot hole there, isn't there?
I've heard the suggestion that as you're walking out, your holographic version of it disappears and a replicated version kind of like instantaneously appears in its place. In my mind, I suspect that more stuff is replicated than is holographic. That's where I would put it. So more stuff can be, you can get more stuff out than you would imagine. So obviously have the holograms for the buildings, the cars, the people, but I suspect a lot of the minor, smaller bits and pieces would be like replicated little trinkets that you could interact with in a much more believable way. But okay. Hey, I mean, who knows?
They could be replicated material, and then when it's no longer needed and you're not taking it out of the holodeck, it's just a matter of putting it in the I don't remember what it's called. They just take it back to matter or to energy. So that's interesting. Yeah,
the big replicator disposal unit.
There you go. Because then I was thinking something gross. What if, you know, Picard was in his office as Dixon Hill and had to go do a doo-doo at the Lulu, and when he leaves a holodeck, would it just, like, drop on the floor for somebody to find? So that's an interesting...
Well, this is, I mean, we're getting very, very close to the question of who cleans the holodeck after Riker's been in there at night.
Yes.
And we really hope that it's a self-cleaning ship.
Yeah, I would hope so, too, because, yeah, poor Ensign. Okay, so anyway, thank you, Data, for sending that. Let's continue on to Funky Psy 1701.
Funky Psy. So it's Simon, and he's Funky Psy. I met him at Star Trek London, and his wife.
Oh, nice. Okay. And he says that this week you have a new listener. For some reason, I haven't listened to the Battle Bridge until now and really enjoyed it. Thank you. I enjoyed your intro. Good to have a bit of Commander Shelby to welcome me in. Oh, great, because that's what we use every week. I'm not a big fan of the holodeck malfunction episodes, but this one was the first and technically wasn't a malfunction. I will give it a pass. I love seeing Data and Geordi as Holmes and Watson. I think they should have done more of it in the show. I heard the reason for this is Arthur Conan Doyle estate wanted royalties. Anyone know if that is truth, if there's any truth in that? I enjoyed the educating Lou on Britain history and crumpets as part of the show, not just entertainment. Look forward to next week's show. Thank you. You said Simon? Simon, thank you.
Simon,
much.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll talk about crumpets in a second, but what do you think about the estate?
It's true. It is true. So what happened was that they used the Sherlock Holmes character, and they believed that he was already in the public domain. Because he's, you know, an old character that has been, you know, that was written, well, a long time ago. And I think that they believed that they were able to use him in the same way that you'd be able to use, you know, Romeo and Juliet and stuff. And it actually transpired that it wasn't yet in the public domain, which is why they got a little bit upset about it. And then it took them a while to, like, iron out on the legal side. So that's why it takes until, I believe it's season 6, correct? Until Message in the Bottle. Message in the Bottle.
Well, when Moriarty comes back again.
No. It's not Message in the Bottle, it's Ship in a Bottle.
Ship in a Bottle.
But it took until that time that they were able to return with the right stuff having been sorted out on the side. So I can't necessarily say that that's correct, but at least that's what I've heard.
Okay.
On the internet, so it must be true.
I wonder what Moriarty thought of the passage of time in legal matters.
I do like the fact that when they do bring Moriarty back, he does mention that it's been, you know, it's been X amount of time, and the primary plot of that episode is that he gets suspicious of trusting the crew again, and I think that the fact that it is indeed like 5 years later rather than 1 year later, I think it reinforces the sympathy that you have with that character.
Yes.
So, I mean, even if they had the right to bring him back every year, I'm not sure that it would have worked as well.
Okay. All right, cool. Well, thanks again, Simon. So let's go on to Data's.
Oh, Data's. The mental image that was brought up about a woman stuck in a deck was from the later episode, In Theory. N. Clancy, played by Anne Elizabeth Ramsey in Elementary Dear Data, does look a lot like Enz Van Meter, played by Georgina Shaw in Theory. At least the hairdos look very similar.
Yeah, they did. That's what I was thinking, too. But okay, cool. Thank you. That provides us a frame of reference. Not a frame of mind, but a frame of reference. Okay. All right, everyone, sit back, and you hear a tale. Okay, Kieran McDuff says, I love this episode. I think this is probably one of my favorites from early seasons of TNG, and it's almost the beginning of a thread that runs all the way through the end of Voyager. It's certainly something that crops up again and again, not just with holograms. What is sentient life? Well, we have a long discussion of that relating to Data soon enough, but go far enough into Star Trek, and you'll find a nice range of O'Brien's puppy on the DS9 Voyagers. On DS9 to Voyager's EMH. Is that the puppy in the computer? If I remember correctly, it was O'Brien's... The computer is trying to please O'Brien. at any chance, just like a puppy would?
Yes, that's it. Sorry, because when you're just reading this out, I'm thinking puppy. I have no idea, and I hope Lou doesn't ask me that. But when you actually put that first block there, you are right. There was an alien, either an alien program or something like that, entered into the computer, and the computer needed O'Brien to be playing with it, to be fixing it.
Right.
And I think he referred to it as a puppy that was that needed attention.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty early DS9, if memory serves, although memory's not what it used to be.
Tell me about it. Yes, I believe he called it Pup 1, if I remember, was the name of the program that got executed. So then basically you put the puppy in the kennel. He says, however, I don't think the idea of a sentient hologram was started in this episode. I always wondered if the idea of Moriarty actually stemmed from somewhat sentient minuet. The Binars programmed her to be at least semi-conscious of what she was, a holographic trap for Riker to be released at the appropriate time. But this proved to be a temporary thing as Riker tried to recreate her and she was gone. So having established that it was indeed possible to make a hologram self-aware, albeit through a very specific programming, it's nice to see them revisit the concept again so soon. Okay, so it was suddenly very easy to make one, he says, and I have to wonder if Riker then had another go at remaking Minuet, but I'm happy to overlook that as simply another holodeck upgrade.
I mean, by the way, we've got a lot of this stuff coming up, right, with The Measure of a Man very soon. And maybe that's going to be a bit of a bumper, because I have a lot of... I was never convinced that Minuet was sentient, and I think that being programmed to be self-aware, or at least aware of what you are, is not necessarily the same thing. But, boy, this is going to... I mean, are we planning to do a two-parter on Measure of a Man? Because I think it's going to be a long one.
You do?
Well, with this debate. I think it's going to be a huge...
We'll see how it goes, and we'll plan accordingly. But I always looked at 1-1-0-0-1-0-0-1 as same as Voyager's worst-case scenario. Because however you play along, the program rewrites itself, or just... It's an algorithm. So when Paris went against Chakotay the first time... He got phasered. Obviously, it started over again. And the second time when he went along with Chakotay, the algorithms changed. So I guess I would say that Minuet the same way. Riker reacted one way. The programming went with that and went this way. If Riker had shunned her or didn't like her at all, he probably would have done something else to keep him in. One way or another, I think Riker was staying in the holodeck, whether he wanted to or not. James?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's... I've always taken Minuet as being like adaptive programming rather than self-aware, conscious, proto-life or anything like that.
Okay.
But I'm not always right. It doesn't matter.
Well, yeah. Okay, I think he goes on to say, I think that's the key to this episode. We've seen the holodeck evolve in the first season, but for me it is the first time the holodeck really comes into its own playing Sherlock Holmes actually looks like fun, even if it is effectively a similar concept to playing Dixon Hill, and follows on nicely from Data's introduction to Sherlock Holmes in Season 1. Holodeck issues aside, I actually like the growth of Data in this episode. Just playing Sherlock Holmes when you know the answer seems a little pointless even to me, so to make a new story seems just right to him, he says. The fact that Geordi's first request isn't enough is terrifically well done, and actually forces him to create the sentient Moriarty. Sometimes these MacGuffins seem to be a little contrived, but this one works really well, especially with Dr. Pulaski nipping away at both of them. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Can I just pick up? Yeah. Because I don't know if we mentioned this in the episode, but did you notice that that Geordi's slip of a tongue there would go on and create the problem? Because I didn't
at the time.
I mean I think they do a bit of a thing where they have the power surge and they cut over to the bridge and Worf looking at the console or whatever, but I certainly didn't I think the point being made here about it looking contrived, I didn't feel like it was looking contrived. I thought it was a standard request, and then it, you know, later transpired to be something else within the plot, but I actually didn't see it as contrived.
No, I really didn't either. I equate it to, let's say, a live television show where there's a studio audience, and sometimes the characters are behind the studio audience. They know what's happening, and when you say something, the studio audience is going to go, oh, because they know what's going to happen based on this. I think if that was the case, when he said, you know, create a fictional character capable of defeating Data, there would have been nothing. Nobody would have said anything, because it makes sense at the time. It's not until they realize later that, oh boy, what have we done? One word, slip of the tongue. I don't think anybody caught that. I know I didn't. Okay, let's go on. He says, I know Pulaski doesn't get a lot of love, at least not till today, but I think she's reached a good point by this episode. She's accepted Data as a person, but spends the rest of the season challenging him to find out what his limits might be. At this point, she still seems adamant that he is limited and is trying to prove it. But later on in the series, I think she changes to the point where she's encouraging him to go beyond those limits. I agree that all the major pieces of this episode combine brilliantly to make a wonderful episode. Today, there are some odd moments in the flash to the bridge of the power surge or the ship shaking, but I can overlook those small aspects. I did always wonder what was happening on Moriarty's chalkboard, so that's slightly disappointed to know it's mostly nonsense. I don't mind when these things have in references, but now I know the speed contradicts what we saw where no one has gone before. But will probably annoy me more, as it really should. Nevertheless, to mark this episode down for those small things wouldn't sit right with me. So I'm definitely giving this episode a full 5 out of 5. By the way, the whole Deerstalker hat issue is done brilliantly by Benedict Cumberbatch's version of Sherlock. It's well worth a watch for many reasons, but his reaction to the hat never fails to make me laugh. And finally, I've considered crumpets to be fat pancakes, which is okay in my book. However, that could be because there's a difference between English crumpets and Scottish crumpets. And he gives a link, so I probably, if I can remember. Okay, so Lou, as you're doing the edit, put that link in the show notes. So look for it there. Either way, I'd be happy. I'd happily put butter on them both and enjoy them. Let's get to the crumpets later. So, but anyway, you had mentioned that you forgot about the call out in the episode on the blackboard speech thing, right?
Yeah, I did. actually, I completely forgotten. And then Furbot mentions that the crumpet picture is exactly what he sent over to you during the episode. Yeah, we're going to have to think about crumpets.
Well, I don't think it was a crumpet. No, he sent us a picture of the chalkboard, wasn't it?
He also sent over crumpets as well.
Oh, I don't remember that. Okay, yeah.
Okay, shall I take QB?
Well, after we say thank you very much for that message there, Kieran, and keep it up. You're like our number one fan. This is cool. So yeah, go on to QB.
Okay, so QB makes 2 points. He said, first, Lou, you need to buy some crumpets and try them live on show. It would be great to hear your initial reaction. Okay. Two, regarding the picture, if someone hands you a piece of paper that's upside down, your automatic reaction will be turn it the right way up, even if it's clear what it is. That's just human nature. Although we've had a minor disagreement in the office about that. One of my colleagues thinks that maybe Geordi's visor is automatically flipping it around for him.
That's an interesting point.
And I think that... I agree. I think that if you did get handed a picture, you would probably keep it the right way up. But, I mean, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't ruin the episode, right? It's not a critical plot point that is completely destroys everything here.
No. It was obviously for the camera's point of for sake. I don't know. I'm sure maybe there's a viewer out there that could look at the Enterprise upside down and not really get that it's the Enterprise. So, unfortunately, it's sad to say, but you know, I don't think it's true. People who love Star Trek are going to know that's the Enterprise. But unfortunately, the writers might think, somebody's out there not hip enough to get it, so let's feed him the correct way. Okay, so Kieran comes back with, yeah, I've heard the visor autocorrect excuse many times over the years as well. That's funny, autocorrect. Okay, now the crumpet deal. I mentioned twice now, two, three times we're going to talk about the crumpets. I had no idea where to find crumpets here in the United States. I can't find them anywhere. I mean, I've done a Google search for crumpets, and they're all over in England or the UK. So I don't know if I really can have crumpets sent to me. But there was a crumpler sampler pack, and then I said, gee, maybe I should send one to James, and we can both try them together at the same time. So I'm not sure. So anybody out there is listening, if you can provide me a link to at least a national thing, website from the U.S. that can get me crumpets, I would love to try it. I'll do it myself and get them, but we'll see. Do you eat crumpets?
Not really, no. I mean, although, you know, having them readily available maybe just takes the mystique off them. I have had a crumpet in the past. I think it's been a while since I've had a crumpet. We don't buy them regularly. Actually, what I was just thinking there is, I mean, surely our fellow Commonwealth citizens over in Canada, do they not have crumpets? It seems like a thing that we would export along with the Queen and...
That's a good point. But I wonder if it'd still be international shipping to send it.
Probably.
I could drive up there for less than what it would cost to have it sent to me. But, okay, well, anyway...
Okay, let me head over to Medic 1849, who's of course been on the show before. He said, hey guys, another great podcast. I finally caught up after falling behind for several weeks. Rather than comment on each episode I missed, I will start from this episode. I originally got hooked on TNG in season 2, so for me, this season is sort of special. I find there are a lot of good episodes, this being one of them. Although I can't stand Pulaski either, she doesn't do a bad job in this episode. I also like the friendship of Data and LaForge is being cemented. You mentioned that Picard treated Moriarty with respect. I agree. However, I would add that he understood how dangerous this character could be, so he needed to be on his A-game when dealing with him. And I'm just coming off the feedback there, I think that's true, and I think that you can see that Picard is a trained diplomat in how he reacts in this case. He's not a... the reaction that Picard, or the way that Picard handled this, is kind of in contrast to how you would imagine Kirk handled in a similar situation.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Anyway, get back to the feedback. Finally, I am a big fan of story arcs, so it was nice to see them call back to this many years later. It would have been nice to see more Sherlock Holmes episodes, but from what I've read, Paramount were told that they have to pay a fee for the use of the characters, hence the delay in the character being brought back. Once again, I enjoyed the banter between the British and American differences. Being Canadian, I find we are stuck in the middle of the two. Now, Medic, if you could let us know whether that includes or excludes the crumpets, that'd be great. We are part of the Commonwealth and understand a lot of British references, yet we are influenced heavily by our neighbours to the south. Keep discussing the difference, as it's fun to listen to. 4 out of 5 stars for me. Now, hopefully, I won't fall behind on my listening.
Yeah. Influenced heavily by the neighbors to the south. Does that mean the drugs we import into Canada?
does that happen? I didn't know that happened.
Oh, well, yeah. Everything, you know, comes from south of us as well. The best stuff. Anyway, that's a different story. I don't do drugs. But I'm sure there's probably a lot of drugs being flooded into Canada. I would imagine.
I would imagine they don't have the climate to grow most of their own.
No, I wouldn't think so. Okay, yeah, thank you very much for that, Blair. That is pretty cool. A 4 out of 5. Real quick, I'm going to pull up Excel, look at our guest list. Let's see what we graded that, because I don't remember. Elementary Dear Data, yes, we both gave it 4, and for Bob gave it a 5. So, yes, Blair, we all agree with you. Okay, let's go on into Unnatural Selection. Let me see. How did I start the log for today? We're meeting up with a medical courier. All we know is our presence is imperative. But yet, somehow, we really never made it to them anyway. We get the chance to check out the prowess of our new chief medical officer. That is, after I interrogate Counselor Troy about her abilities. Okay. Sorry. Log wasn't as interesting this week as last week, I will admit.
Now, I'm surprised that, I think we mentioned right at the beginning, I don't know why this is happening now. It almost sounds something like they wanted to include something like this earlier on in the season when Pulaski was much more fresh-faced. But then again, it's only been seven episodes, so maybe because I'm misremembering and stuff, I'm getting confused here. I'm surprised that he asks for... Picard seems a little nervous for some reason, and he does ask Troy's analysis, and to me it doesn't sound like Troy's not going to turn around and say, well, I think she's horrendous and incompetent and I preferred the old doctor, can we get her back next season? So I didn't really know what I think this was a bit of time filling, to be perfectly honest with you.
Really? Or maybe setting her up to be the hero of the episode?
Well, I mean, it's certainly but of course this is clearly a Pulaski-centric episode. I didn't particularly need all of this Pulaski glory that was going on, but I can take or leave it. It's all fine.
You raise a good point that I never considered, is the fact that why is Picard sitting in there with his hand on his head trying to figure out why, is he maybe... Pulaski's 90-day evaluation is up and he's got to send something to Starfleet and he hasn't really spent much time with her, so let's get other people's input. That's the only thing I can think of, because there's no reason for that.
Yeah, that's right. So he's sitting there, he's thinking, well, I have to make a choice now, otherwise we have to keep her for at least 5 years and pay her medical fees as well.
Yeah.
And insurance. Perhaps that's what's going on.
Or he found out that she's not in his HMO. Or something like that, I don't know. And of course that's the American thing. Okay, so now the ship is getting a distress call from the USS Lantry, a supply ship, saying that they can't hold out anymore. The dying need to help. The Enterprise arrives to find no life signs on the ship. And so, obviously the choice that usually gets made in this type of a situation is, let's beam over and see what's going on there. But no, not today. We're not beaming over there, because that would have made more sense in, say, Matter of Time, where they did beam over and they brought the Sizzle back, if you remember the Sizzle. It's a good call into what we were going to pull up, but...
That's the Naked Time.
The Naked Time. Now. Oh, excuse me.
The Naked Now.
You got that right. I'm going to leave that mistake in there just for the fun of it. The Naked Now. So they obviously beamed over when they... probably should have tapped into the ship's computer just like we do today. But they use a computer to tap into the view screen, and it looks like everybody has died of old age. But still, is that enough? Do you think that they wouldn't have beamed over or beamed, say, the captain back for an autopsy?
I mean, I had not considered this, I'm afraid. I'm really ashamed to admit that. So the way they go about this episode, and it's not just here, but it's also later when Pulaski and Picard are debating about whether or not to bring one of the children on board, they are being very, very cautious about the possibility of contagion. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, I think they're right. I think that the behavior in this episode is correct. The only problem that leaves me with is that all the behavior in all the other episodes is reckless. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't... You notice in this episode that they've been very, very careful, and you'd with good reason. But I never realized that they weren't this careful elsewhere, and they really should have been.
Hmm. Okay, well, maybe we can give them an out by saying their activities on the Naked Now caused a new order to be put into place.
And actually, I think that pretty early on, right, they realize that they've been to the genetic research station, and maybe. Given the, it's not like a subspace anomaly or anything like that. On the ground that they had been there, and it's probable, at least, that might have something to do with it. Maybe they just thought of being hyper-cautious.
Okay. So do you think Picard would really have to go into his ready room to enter a special code of Omicron, Omicron, Alpha, Yellow, Daystar, 2-7, Enable? I mean, if he did that on the bridge, do you think Wesley could have remembered that, went somewhere and, say, he wanted to tap into Counselor Troy's bedroom view screen by using Omicron, Omicron, Alpha, Yellow, Daystar, 2-7?
Well, actually, again, this is Picard being sensible and the script being properly written, right?
Yeah.
Because fundamentally, this is like a password thing that Picard has. And we already know that, you know, Wesley, if he got the password, he could voice synthesize, Picard, and he could take over the ship. So again, this is the episode being doing what you're supposed to do, but now it just leaves all of the other instances looking slightly reckless. Like, really, I didn't notice that one either.
Right, like when he, you know, does he initiate the self-destruct authorization Picard, whatever it was. I mean, what if Wesley did that, or would the computer say, yeah, no, I'm not falling for this, you're not Picard. You're right. Could be reckless. Or, like you say, in the later episode, when he gives Moriarty the command codes. Oops.
No, yeah, you're right. He does that over the intercom, right?
Yeah. Because he didn't realize he was actually on a holodeck.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, let's see. Do you think maybe... I was also thinking, the reason why he went into the ready room is there has to be a system set up to take control of another ship that may have come from, say, Khon Singh. You know, taking control of any other ship, and Spock takes control of what was the name of the ship that he was on?
The Reliant.
The Reliant. Yeah, he had the
and
Reliant.
And obviously, they're obviously using the model of the Reliant here as well.
Nice.
So it's the same ship type.
Yes, nice.
But no, it's strange. So, I mean, all of this, it's strange that, you know, they first find this, you know, this ship, they look at it, they don't beam on board, they kind of try to react properly, and now they're heading over to the kind of the genetic research station. And the only thing that, this episode is a bit weird, right, in the sense that, okay, they are doing all of these things properly, and it kind of shows them to have not done them properly in the past. But also, when they're talking about these genetic research that seems to be going on...
Hey, before you head there, I'm sorry, before you head there, I actually wanted to talk a little more about the Langtree. And
okay.
The, they said to turn on her marker beacon and a quarantine beacon. And it actually, you know, you hear that, you know, the USS Langtree is a quarantine vessel by order of Starfleet Command. Do not board. Two questions on that is, one... Starfleet Command didn't have anything to do with this. Do they just... That's a quarantine beacon that Captain Picard or Pulaski decided and Starfleet Command would just agree with and go with?
Yeah, I think it's okay. I think that's fine. I think it's... It's under an order that would have been issued by Starfleet Command.
Right. If you come across a situation and the doctor feels a quarantine is necessary, then this is what we'll do, and it's by order of command. Makes sense. But then the marker beacons, wouldn't that just pretty much tell anybody in the vicinity, here's a ship here? And you can't expect the packleds are going to... the packleds would tractor beam that thing away.
And I think almost immediately, right? If that thing either had a functioning warp core or some dilithium on it, or some photon torpedoes, you would have expected people to be raiding this.
Yes.
You know, as soon as you say, please don't touch this ship over here, it's quarantined, I mean, people are going to be boarding it. So you need to have... I think you need to do something with it a little bit better than they did. Now, maybe they're only going to leave it there for like 24 hours as they had to finish off their adventure. But had it been any longer, I'm sure the thing would have been crawling with Ferengi by the time they got back.
Soon to be dead Ferengi. Well, it depends on if the Ferengi molecular structure would react the same way. Okay, good point. Okay, now go on about the quarantine.
Oh, no, so we head over to the station, and I was surprised watching how quickly we get there, because the big about the Langtree, we encounter them, but then we fundamentally head over to the research station almost straight away, and they the woman who answers the hail seems to know Dr. Pulaski, and again, more Pulaski love coming on this week.
Yes, the author of Viral Propagation and something, or...
No, that's it. It was Linear Models of Viral Propagation.
There we go.
And that doesn't... I don't want... that actually doesn't sound very impressive.
Well, sure, it was hard when he looked over at her, like, And she's trying to play it off. Oh, that was a long time ago. And she even, you know... It was funny. It was hilarious when she looked at Picard like, please, don't pretend you never heard that.
Yeah, but okay, let me just deconstruct what the paper was. Okay, so it's viral propagation. So, i.e., how viruses react in your body. Now, I'm sorry, but you would expect most doctors to be able to at least have a working understanding of how viruses propagate. And then the first part is linear models. And linear models is the simplest model you can mathematically define. So I don't think this is particularly great work here. And I know maybe I'm the only person that's pulling her up on her scientific credentials. But I would have expected there to be a more, a more over-the-top tech.
Maybe it was a children's answer. Book.
That's maybe that's right.
And she read it to her... She's only 35 years old, so she read it to her baby when, 7 years ago when a toddler. That's funny. Okay.
Oh, hang on. Let me just... Sorry, I completely forgot about this. The Lantry. Mm-hmm. So how long do you think they spent getting old? Because I imagine it's, several days at least that they would have been aware that they're getting older.
3 days. Well, how long before they started getting old? It probably was pretty quick, but they say that they think they were infected by supply courier from 3 days ago, I believe.
Okay. No distress signal? No, no warning? No, because when you come across the ship, you're kind of like having to deduce a lot of these issues. You see a very old captain and stuff. No one's written down a note saying, we ran into the ship, we've now getting old, we seem to be, losing our mind, and it happened this way, that way, and the other. I mean, it seemed to be hard to find the information on their illness, or harder than you would imagine. A bunch of, 26 crew or so, dying of old age. You would have thought the information would have been more readily forthcoming.
That's a good point, because Gagarin Station didn't put out a... She just now declared a medical emergency 3 days after the incident occurred. That's an interesting point. You would think, hey, we're all suffering from arthritis. We're all getting older. We need to tell someone.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the main woman is, she's aged, 15 years, something like that, maybe more, given the fact that people are healthier and younger in the 24th century. So you would have thought that they would have noticed earlier.
Mm-hmm. Another thing, since women lie about their age all the time. Ooh, Lou, why'd you say that? So for her to say that, doctor, I just celebrated my 35th birthday last week. I bet you she does that everywhere she goes. I'm still 35. I was 35 in 1990. I'm 35 now. So, okay. As a matter of fact, I'm going to do that. Let's pull her up. Dr. Sarah Kane. Patricia Smith. Let's see when she was born. Because they do give that out. Oh, so she was born in 1930. And like we say, the episode was in 1990, right? 1989, yes. Okay. So... 30 to 89, obviously she was 59 at the time, so still looking good for 59, I will say that. Since I pretty much have insulted all females out there, now it's time to at least say something nice about them. Okay, where are we on my notes? Oh, yeah, the Darwin Genetic Research Station. Darwin, that should have been our first clue. You ever heard of the Darwin Awards?
Yes.
How people manage to do something to kill themselves?
Yeah, you're talking about the it's an award. I mean, I don't think it's not an award you want to win. No. But for anyone out there that isn't aware of them, there are awards that are the Darwin Awards given out to people who have successfully removed their genome from their DNA from the human genome. So that's the wrong way to explain it. People that end up killing themselves by doing stupid stuff, they right. get an award. And the idea being that they're no longer in the gene pool, and as such, the species as a whole is getting progressively better by the exclusion of these guys.
Right. So to call the station the Darwin Genetic Research, that's pretty good. I mean, they obviously were thinking of Charles Darwin at the time. You think?
No, of course. I think like a clear reference to Charles Darwin, which was effectively about the theory of evolution and that kind of stuff that was proposed by him.
Yes. So Dr. Kingsley, she's more concerned about the children, who were their greatest work, and she would like the children evacuated immediately because they're not showing any signs. So the idea, what do you think of the idea of encasing a 12-year-old child that looks more like 23? And I mean, that 12-year-old boy was just absolutely phenomenal, wasn't he? I'm not sure how old he really is in real life, but
yeah, let's hope he's not 12.
That was a little strange, but anyway, so while on the ship, Pulaski tries to study it thoroughly, but can't do any more until the styrolite is removed. No way, not today. Nope, ain't gonna happen. So what do you think of the use of styrolite to put him in suspended animation? That's not something we ever see again.
No, I don't think it is anything we see again. I mean, other people write... Am I right in thinking that Kayla traveled in suspended animation while she was on board the torpedo ship that comes up a little later in this episode? But it is kind of like a common trope of sci-fi where you put people in suspended animation, and in general Star Trek doesn't really use it very much, right? Whenever you have like a medical emergency on the ship, in a couple of weeks time we're going to have the issue of Picard's heart. I don't think people suggest they because it's inconvenient now to sort this out, instead of send him in a shuttle that's going to take 52 years to get there, just put him in suspended animation while you do your detour, and then you can get him over to wherever you need him to be. So it seems that Star Trek in general doesn't do these suspended animation kind of get out of jail free cards that often. For this specific case of getting a effectively insulating the guy, I think it's fine. I don't have a huge amount to say on it. I thought it was a little bit weird that it looked a little weird, and I wouldn't want to be encased in it. But when a little bit later, when Pulaski kind of removed it, it seemed to come off okay. Didn't seem to be any sticky stuff left behind.
That's what made me wonder if it was actually real. If there was a couple things I wonder. Number one, was that a mannequin that was laying on the bed until she took the styrolite off, or was it a human just laying there and then post production put in the styrolite because she just got it off rather easy and he just got right up? So I'm not sure which one would be the truth.
And I think that it was a physical effect. So I think that they did film him in this bubble thing. And I think that when they have the scene of it being cut off, I think it's just I think it's the two shots that they had. So they had the shot, so they have the computer controlled camera panning, and I think they had it with it and then without it, and they were able to splice them together to look at, so that it appeared that it disappeared. Hmm. That's what my guess would be, because I mean, we are talking before the day of sophisticated computer animation, which we're going to come to when we have the Dauphin in a couple of weeks time. You can see that there's clearly lacking sophisticated computer animation in that episode.
Yeah, it was pretty good for its time though.
Are we talking about the Dauphin?
Yeah.
I mean, with the Morphin.
Anya and Celia, yeah. It was pretty good for its time. You don't think?
Okay.
You don't think so?
Actually, well, having said that, I mean, I don't think I wouldn't have seen it at its time. I would have seen it. Well, first of all, there's the England issue, which means we're 3 years behind you guys anyway.
Oh, yeah.
And then I think that I would have seen it maybe a couple of years after that. And actually, considering where visual effects and where the technology was going in the early 90s through to really 2000, there was such a huge explosion in this tech that it was very, it's very easy for things to look dated. So, you know, I don't know if you know, if you look back at films that were like, you know, hugely successful films with very sophisticated CGI, they look pretty ropey, or some of them can. And one thing I love most about Trek, in particular TNG did not jump on the CGI ships at all. I think at all. And I think it really benefits because a lot of the visual effects still, the model work, really, really, really stands up. Mm-hmm. And I think jumping too early onto that tech would have been a mistake.
Okay.
But I've gone off on a tangent.
That's okay.
I am sorry.
That's all right. Yeah, you got it over released in the UK. VHS release on July 1st, 1991. So, yeah, it's interesting. Why they? I wonder. Do you have any idea? Speaking of tangents, do you know any idea why BBC or Star didn't release it? Was there a Star in 1989?
No.
Okay, how about BBC and why they wouldn't have had this series on?
I think the truth of the matter isn't like a great conspiracy or anything. It's simply that you know, the BBC and people in Britain bought stuff produced and made, you know, in Britain, and unless something was extremely, extremely, extremely successful, it literally would not be exported to the UK, and it wasn't considered a priority. I mean, we missed a lot of stuff, and missed a lot of series in the US, and big popular series. I mean, one thing that always surprises me is that, you know, things like Seinfeld were huge series in the US, right? Mm-hmm. Barely anyone has seen anything in the UK. Oh. It was never exported properly. It was never shown at the right time, and it was just one of those things that we missed. So being a couple of years behind, frankly, I'm surprised it was only a couple of years. I think that other countries can, like, you know, skip the Next Generation entirely just because they weren't. I don't think people were focused with the foreign territories as much as they are now.
Okay, cool. All right, then. Let's see here. So we're good with the Starlight. They beam the child to a shuttlecraft so that he can't possibly infect anybody on the Enterprise. And of course, turns out that number one, the child is a full telepath. Just when Pulaski thinks everything is fine, she gets an attack of arthritis in her arm, which is the first sign that she is affected, so she decides to join the quarantine on the planet. Can you imagine any reason why they would make them completely telekinetic and full telepaths?
That's a great question. Now, I mean, a lot of this, right? A lot of this doesn't make any sense because we're supposed to be like in the post-Khan world of the Federation, and you know, I thought like genetic research like this was, you know, was forbidden anyway. But I know we haven't really picked up, you know, the Khan thread again. That has, you know, that would have been that is mentioned later in DS9 with Julian Bashir and so on.
Yeah.
But even so, I still find it rather far-fetched that just with a bit of tinkering, you can get telepaths and telekinetic abilities out of humans. I think that that's a little bit weird. And I think that if nowadays you wanted genetic research to be done, I think you have to jump through a lot more hoops and have a lot more controls than what appears to be present in this episode. You certainly wouldn't be able to have, you know, hey, I've got a bunch of telekinetic kids and I'm keeping in a room. To me, it seemed a bit over the top.
Right, because you would think if they're full telepaths, is the glass between Dr. Kingsley and the children enough to keep them from probing her mind about how worried she is about this? Or do they actually know what's going on because they're just continuing their playfulness as children do?
And also, you would have thought, I mean, going into that, right, is that if they were under threat, because no one, and at no point are the children put out as being, you know, they're not put out as being fighting for their lives or anything. So that's just like, you know, benign bunch of people that are just sitting there on the side. You would have thought if they're telepathic, they would know what the seriousness of the situation, and they would potentially realize that, you know, once the adults die, then these guys would you know, die of starvation or whatever it would be. So you might think that they might want to preserve their own lives and, you know, take over the station and maybe take the shuttle and go and see what they can do elsewhere. Mm. So I'm surprised that, you know, these guys are very, very, well, benign was the word I used. That pretty much, you know, they're pretty much people in a cage that don't seem to react in any way.
No. I know the one child knew something was going on in the shuttle because Pulaski picks it up and said, it wasn't your fault. So I thought that was kind of a cute little moment too as well. You know, she obviously heard him apologizing for what happened, and, you know, she reacts to it saying, it wasn't your fault. And that was pretty nice too.
Actually, can I quickly scoot back one tiny, tiny, tiny bit, which was that, you know, going back into the common theme that Picard's being a reasonable person, you know, they do have this argument about whether or not they can take out the, you know, take the child out and look at him, you know, behind a force field. And, you know, Picard quite rightly states that, you know, force fields can fail. And, you know, we know full well that a force field, or at least a critical force field, will fail as soon as anyone fires a phaser at you, from the ship's perspective. And I actually think that, yeah, there's a lot of good, sensible behavior by Picard in this episode, which doesn't really get replicated in other episodes.
Oh, yeah. Even like she says, sick bay is on its own system. Now that's, you can't separate it from the rest of the ship. So essentially, even if she was able to, they'd have to dock the ship, get everybody off, and destroy it.
You could have always, of course, separated the saucer section.
Right. Where's the sick bay, though? Which section is that in?
Okay, I always thought that sick bay was in the saucer section, but in Generations they evacuate the sick bay when they're going to crash. So that suggests it's in the star drive.
Okay, yes, that makes sense. Okay, so anyway, the children are telekinetic, but the masterpiece was their aggressive immunity system. The immunity found a virus that the Langtree's first officer had, the Luzian flu, but it didn't wait until the virus invaded the children's bodies. It seeked out the virus and tried to destroy it by altering the genetic code of the virus. I mean, I'm surprised Dr. Kingsley didn't figure this whole thing out way before she did. You know, it's not going to wait for them to be infected. It's going to go after the virus. Duh. You know...
Very, 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 very true. And right at the beginning of the episode, Pulaski can, like, ask her, you know, is this anything that you might have done? You know, are you responsible for this? And she's categorically states, this is not something that we've created that has gone away from us. And it categorically is. And it's almost so clear that it would be, given, you know, the background of the children and the genetic engineering that's going on.
Right, because actually... Troy says, I believe Dr. Kingsley when she says that the children are not infected, but she's not telling us the whole truth. So do you think this whole idea of the genetic research that she's did, it probably she didn't quite tell Starfleet the whole truth and nothing but the truth?
I'm willing to accept that she told Starfleet, but I suspect that it's a relatively high important project where, you know, where this is obviously a trial run, and they're probably not telling everyone that they're producing this, you know, this super immune system and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. There's another interesting thought I was just thinking. This bug, okay, I could see why their active immune system would have attack the first officer's Deluzian flu by changing its altering its molecular structure, right? Or genetic ones and zeros, I suppose. But I'm trying to figure out how the first officer then infected the rest of the crew. I mean, this bug that he's carrying, I could see it coming from the children to the rest of the crew, but not from the first officer to the rest of the crew. I mean, do you think it's the same as if I sneeze on you, you're going to get a cold?
I mean, it must be. They must. I'm just trying to think about whether or not it is. No, it must be the case that one of the children put something across, so some of his DNA, some of his super-duper immune system got into the other guy's body, at which point it started going after the virus, mutated the virus, to try to kill it, and then did something to his DNA. And then I assume at that point he starts then spreading the kind of immunity thing inside him from the child onto other people. So I suspect, I think the only way it could work is that if the immunity kind of get little thing that came out of the child effectively started now acting as a virus on its own.
And then I was also wondering how did he infect the rest? It had to be by air, unless the first officer had contact with every single person on the ship. I suppose the ship of 26, it's possible.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, I don't know what's going on in the UK, but I know over here we're all freaking out about Ebola. I never heard of it till 3 months ago when the first patient came here to Omaha, to our medical center. And I don't know if you've been up to date with that, but yeah, we've cured two people now, two doctors of Ebola here at the med center.
No, I mean, it is making news over here. We don't have, or the UK hasn't had a case yet. Although, no doubt, if and when that happens, then people will start getting a lot more panicked. But
yeah, they are.
At the moment, it's relatively quiet on that side, and you just see, obviously, the infections and the, I don't know if it's an epidemic or not, because that's a technical definition, but the outbreak in Africa is highlighted, and as is a couple of the cases you've had in Europe and America.
Yeah.
Usually with aid workers, right? Aid workers or medical people coming back from the affected locations.
Right. And now the biggest story is the nurse in, I think, Texas, who's refusing to cooperate with the government's quarantine of her for 21 days. So, yeah, this is getting rather interesting because, like I said, I have never heard of Ebola. I guess it was prominent back in the 70s, and it's been happening over in Africa. But, hey, out of sight, out of mind. And that's probably why we've never really heard about it before, because it's not something that came here until that first doctor. And now, all of a sudden, boom, it's on the news every single day. News crews are just salivating over this Ebola thing. Okay, so anyway, back to Star Trek. Picard is inquiring from Dr. Taggart's... I'm sorry. I said that because my wife's OBGYN, when she gave birth, was Dr. Taggart. Picard is inquiring from Captain Taggart of Pulaski's last posting on the Repulse about why he would let her go. Turns out that she's been an admirer of Picard's for some time. I wonder where that comes from. I mean, the fact that she's always butted heads with Picard, and then we find out maybe she's had a little thing for Picard for such a very long time.
I didn't read it as she's had a thing for Picard.
Really?
I try not to think of these things.
So he's not the Austin Powers of the Enterprise? You know, not quite as good-looking as you might think, but women just can't help but be drawn to him?
I hope not. I hope not. I found it something strange, because the relationship between Picard and Pulaski. I mean, there's a bit where Pulaski is talking to Troy, and she sums up. Well, first of all, it's strange that Pulaski is in any way concerned about her relationship, because I get the impression that Pulaski is the kind of person that, if it's not working, I don't think she would care. I don't think she would go out of her way to kind of to smooth it over. But there's a point where Troy says to her, and seems to reassure her with a statement that, you know, you both of you seem to have well-established personalities. And I was kind of thinking, as opposed to what exactly? I mean, I think, you know, even pets have well-established personalities. You'd have to be very weird not to have a well-established personality. So I was a bit confused as to why that was something that she could take comfort from.
Well, let me think here for a second. I was just thinking that well-established personality probably means outgoing and dominant.
Well, it's probably a euphemism to be, you know, a complete pain in the backside and an authoritarian.
So in other words, what Troy's trying to say, Deanna's trying to say is politely say, you know, at times you can be a B and he can be a D. You get it? This is just the way you two are. And hopefully everybody got that so I didn't have to say it. So, now, the Darwin Station. They figured out... Oh, yeah, no, hold on. Before we go to that... Hold on. I have completely stepped over important details of the cure. Let's talk about the cure. They find out that Pulaski... Obviously, they couldn't get a transporter trace. They erased him. The Repulse erased Pulaski's transporter traces after she left. Is there... You think there'd be a reason why? They said it was for security, mainly.
It's probably the... they probably need the space back in their computer.
Ah.
They're probably just getting rid of... You know, they're doing the disk tidy-up job. I mean, we at my work, we've got a whole load of directories on our shared drive of people that have left the bank. And sometimes I think, well... You know, should we get rid of these? We don't need them anymore. This person hasn't been here for like 4 years. So maybe they're just having a tidy up of all the data that they don't need. I need to make a point, though, about the transporter trace thing. Mm-hmm. It's not going to work. It doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. What O'Brien says isn't true. And I know that it's a transporter, but let's just assume that the transporter was able to work. What he says still wouldn't make sense. Because what he is suggesting is that the pattern, the physical pattern, in some way would not have changed between the trace and where she is now. And they were able to use that as a guideline. But the thing is that when you're being beamed, right, it's not just you and your genetic material, but it's your clothes, it's whatever you had for breakfast that morning. And I would imagine it's so difficult to distinguish all of these things that you wouldn't just be able to, you know, you wouldn't be able to use it as a baseline. The fact is that you're going to be 2-3 years older. You're going to have, you know, put on weight, had some food, changed your shoes, your socks. All of that is going to just make it impossible, surely, to use that as a baseline.
So if that's...
Anyway, that's just a...
No, that's a good point, because if that's the case, then they would have actually beamed her from before she joined the Enterprise... Maybe even before she found out there was an opening on the Enterprise, and she would beam on board the Enterprise wondering, how the hell did I get here, and who are you people?
Oh, yeah, and actually, absolutely. So the trace would also include memories, because your memories would be different, right?
Yeah.
Because it's a physical thing. So unless they're going to actively exclude certain parts of the trace, so they say, well, we're going to use the trace as a way of making sure that we beam only her immune system over as it was then, but it's very difficult to say that you're going to isolate this part of the body without isolating that part of the body, and certainly when you don't know what you're looking for. So to me, this seemed like a long shot at very, very least.
Oh, even their solution is a long shot. I can't understand how they can get a single strand of hair with live follicles.
I've got stuff on that. We'll come to it. I've got stuff on that.
Oh, go to it, because that's really where we are, the solution. It just seemed like they had to come up with this possible solution to end the story, or else we'd have been sitting up there till she died. So go on. What do you have?
Okay, so what has happened so far is that a virus has mutated her DNA, and that part of her DNA controls the aging process. Fine. Okay, I don't have a problem with that. If that's what you want to set up, that's fine. Then what they do is they find some other parts of her DNA, so the full DNA structure in her hair. Fine, I'm not going to argue with that. I'm going to assume that you find, you know, find that there. I don't even think you'd need to have it alive, to be perfectly honest with you, as long as it's something you can reconstitute. Now, what this would do, if you were to beam someone and you were then to be able to change all of the DNA within every single cell, so that effectively you reset her to how she was before, you would not de-age her. She would go from someone who was not, that had this, you know, quick aging disease, to someone who didn't have this quick aging disease, but the actual time that she had the quick aging disease would still have passed. So she would look exactly the same as she did on the station. So I don't understand, and I think it's a bit of a gap, that they managed to roll back time. You don't roll back time by curing yourself of a disease. That's like saying that, you know, you've got a very bad, you've got a, you know, let's say that you do pick up a virus somewhere, and or you've got gangrene and you have to cut off your arm, and then then you cure the gangrene, your arm doesn't come back. So I don't know how that proposal this is supposed to work in this case.
That's true. That has to be a contrivance, because I think, isn't it Pulaski that says these two genes here have been reversed?
Yeah, so the two parts, you know, two sections of her DNA. So the fact that they've changed it means that she's been aging quickly. They change it back, you solve the problem. But you don't reverse time.
Good point. That makes perfect sense.
I'm sorry. I'm being very pedantic here. And please feel free for everyone to shout me down on this, because actually I think this episode's been a lot of fun. I think this has been been a good ride, and they've been sensible, and there's been relatively good character development, and the Pulaski character's coming off very well, and she's trying to solve the problem here, and it's a scientific-y story, and they're putting out. It's not particularly deep, the stuff on the genetic engineering, but it is being put out there, and it's nice. It's a nice episode. It's just that you don't get to the age, or the effects of an illness that you've had don't disappear once you've been cured of that illness.
Mm-hmm. No, you know, I would not see any reason to give you any guff about that.
Oh, please.
No, I'm serious, because think about it. You're a scientist. You see these. You don't see this, but you've got a better grasp on what could and could not be versus what I do. So that's why I like the fact that you come from a scientific point of view, and I just have a Star Trek point of view. And that's probably why we really are really cool on this. So no, don't apologize. I think this is what they want. They've said it in the feedbacks before. They love it when you do the scientific inaccuracy of the week. They love it when you're schooling us on science like this and what's real and what's not. So you're not putting it down for just putting it down's sake. You're actually thinking in the box that you live in and saying, is this possible? Oh, that's actually pretty cool that you do that.
So, and by the way, I don't think this takes away from the story. I don't. I think that you have fun with things, and you know, I've said this before, right? They're trying to solve a problem here with a medical approach or a scientific approach, or at least, and also on top of that, an approach that's born out of the characters attempting to be clever.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing that really I like most about Trek. They're not having to resort to magic. And I know sometimes the technology can be like magic, but the big difference in my mind is that all of this is available because people's learning and people's, you know, pushing the boundaries of what human understanding is. And I think that's the central thing that I always love. Now, they didn't get all the science right, and they didn't get all the science right, and we accept it. Even when they have, you know, a little box that they put in there and they want to play within that box. Like I think in this episode they do. But it doesn't ruin the episode. And I don't think it very rarely ruins the episode.
Yeah. I think if we were to actually think about if the follicle of hair with the live cells is inaccurate or they shouldn't have used it, what should they have used to make her come back to what she was? And I thought, well, skin cells that were laying around sick bay, but we know that the ship is a very sterile place, so therefore you're not going to find skin cells anywhere. So really, if you think about it, that's another question I'm curious about. When she transported to the Enterprise, was it really by shuttle from the Repulse?
I think they must have looked into that, because I don't remember, but I think it must have been. They did meet the Repulse, right? In the Child, and I suppose it's not out of the realm of the possibility that they ended up sending them over some cargo that they didn't beam over, and she was just on the shuttle.
She came with her luggage. Well, I don't know. That's an interesting question, that she never used a transporter, because, you know, Picard says never. You know, she's a woman of deeply, I don't know, mixed emotions. I don't know. Hard feelings or whatever the case may be.
And actually, I mean, I think that the transporter stuff comes up again with Barclay a little later on, mm-hmm. When he starts getting this transporter psychosis, mm-hmm. and then it's also mentioned that he avoids the transporter. And I think at the time he hadn't used the transporter, or at least it's not shown that he had used it. I think that the only instance on screen of him using it was when he gets knocked out in the Nth degree and he gets beamed back as an emergency. But again, something, and I think that's transporter psychosis is, that's like season 6.
Yeah.
And you've already had like three good years of Barclay stories, and they are right. He hasn't used a transporter, and he has, you are able to take that new facet of his personality and project it onto him.
I can't imagine how. I just can't imagine how he could possibly have gotten away from it. Even in the Academy, transporter is going to be used on a daily basis, if not even learning how to use a transporter or something. Or there's got to be something in the Academy classes about transporters, and you got to be able to go through it. And if not, you're not a very good candidate for Starfleet. That's a fascinating, interesting story. Okay. So the Darwin Station has to be quarantined forever, and the children must live out their lives alone as well. I was thinking, no, that's not necessarily true. I could see that the planet must be quarantined, but do you think the children would be smart enough if they're alone, the adults have died? That doesn't mean that they have to live the rest of their life in the quarantine bubble that was created for them. They're going to be able to get out and enjoy the whole planet to themselves, right?
I would have thought that even if it wasn't that planet, they would be able to find a planet to settle down in, I would have thought.
That's the problem. Once they leave that planet, now they run the risk of infecting the galaxy. So they can never leave that planet. As long as they're on that planet, the galaxy's safe. But once they get off, we're all screwed. So that's the thing. As they got older, because 12 years old and they look like they do now, they probably would have developed space travel.
Yeah, maybe. Now, actually, by the way, when the guy gets beamed over and he's 12 years old and Worf looks at him and he goes, oh, it's a... He doesn't say it's a trap, but he goes, oh, it's a trick, it's a or trick. Something. It reminded me of one of my kind of pet peeves, and I actually ended up looking it up, because he seems surprised that a 12-year-old is so large, right? I think that was fundamentally it. So let me ask you a question, Lou. How old was Alexander when he was serving aboard the Klingon Bird of Prey? Did he serve aboard the Rattaran?
Yes, I believe so.
How old was he then?
Oh, that's a good question. I would have guessed anywhere between 17 or 18, perhaps.
Because he was 8 at that point.
He was 8 during DS9 era?
Yep, because he's not born until like season 3 of TNG.
Yeah.
So he's born after him and Worf and Kayla meet up later on in season 2. Mm-hmm. And obviously it's one of those things, right? Because whenever you have a TV child, you want them to grow up and do interesting things quicker. And I know in this particular case they've got an out by saying that he's a Klingon child, and Klingon child would just grow faster. But when I teach, if you do and count the years that go by, when Alexander makes his final appearance and he's, his weapons officer on board, in the Klingon, in the Dominion War, mm-hmm. he's 8 years old. Human years old.
Fascinating. I guess him and Naomi Wildman might have something in common.
Yeah. Do you think something they put in the milk or put in the water, super growth hormones?
I certainly don't think Klingons drink milk. No, it's a good question. I never really, as much as I've actually considered the Naomi Wildman thing, and I at one point had a timeline that made it make no sense, but even if she was half Katarian, is that it? No.
I'm not good on that. I don't know.
I think it's Katarian. I don't know. I bet you Data knows. But, yeah, I actually worked on that. I've never thought about the Alexander one. That's good job there.
Actually, didn't Naomi Wildman stay pregnant for like 2 years?
Naomi Wildman was never pregnant that I know of. It was Samantha.
Sorry, indeed, yes, her mom. But she had an extended pregnancy, right?
Yes. Yes, she was. Yeah, had to be pregnant well over a year. Has to be the half-Katarian thing. Yeah.
Absolutely.
No. No. Naomi was never pregnant. That's not to say that she was never molested by Neelix, who some people find him to be. But that's a different story altogether. Okay, so let's see here. I do like one thing Pulaski says. It was pretty awesome when she says that if she lives through this, she'll have a much better understanding of geriatrics.
But that was a joke, right? I took that as a joke.
Yes,
I took a bit of gallows humor, and I thought it was a good, nice line.
But I took it as a joke. She's being facetious, but still, it is true. Yeah, when she deals with geriatrics, she's going to, I know what you're going through. Believe it or not, I spent 2 days as a really, really old bitch. And, excuse me, as a really, really old person. And it hurt. So, yeah, anyway. So, Brian is, did you find it weird that O'Brien was concerned that, you know, this transport is one way. If it doesn't work, there's no beaming her back to the planet. So Picard decides he'll do the transporter on Brian, so O'Brien doesn't feel guilty about it going wrong. Does that make sense to you?
No, that didn't make sense to me. And if anything, I thought that would, you know, it shouldn't be a responsibility that the captain has to step up to. I think that there are many people on the ship that would have been happy to stand in for O'Brien if he had any issues about this, because it's just not an issue, right?
No, it shouldn't be. And besides, Picard working the controls to get Pulaski back, that made no sense to me. He's not a transporter or technologist.
No, absolutely. And right, you want to give it your best shot as a professional, and if that, you know, if you give it the best shot, then you really should be able to accept the consequences of that. And unless, of course, Picard happens to be a better transporter chief than O'Brien.
Right.
But that doesn't sound right.
No, I don't know that. That's true. But still, O'Brien went over to the medical scanner. I mean, O'Brien's reading a medical scanner to make sure that the stack is right. That he still had his hand in it. Because Picard is saying, it's not working. Uh-oh, here we go. And, you know, O'Brien says, no, wait, Captain, let me do some corrections here. So really, he was still just as much involved as he was before. In fact, I guess you could say, if O'Brien was at the control and the unnamed ensign was at the medical scanner, it may not have worked properly. Who knows? So anyway, the transporter does its thing, so they could do the rest for the Darwin station. Okay, here's an interesting question for you. They say that the adults can never be with the children again. They must be isolated from the children forever, right? I don't understand why. Nobody's got the Thalusian flu anymore. Does that mean that the children's immune system is just going to attack everybody for no reason?
Well, I mean, I think realistically on paper, though, I mean, these, whatever immunity system that you've invented, that you've placed into these kids, it's dangerous. And it's, you know, I know that, again, the episode doesn't make clear whether it was this particular flu that happened to cause this reaction, or whether it would be any virus of any sort that would have this similar reaction or not. But I think, unfortunately, some of the realistic outcomes of having this kind of experiment go wrong is that you would end up euthanizing the children and starting again, which is not a very good tone to end the episode on.
No, because there's no saying how long those children will live. So really, the children could outlive the... wait a minute. The children will outlive the adults anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which means they're still in the position where they could infect the rest of the galaxy if they leave that planet, or if anyone ever shows up to that planet. So, really, you're right. The only way to ensure the contagion doesn't go beyond Gagarin is to destroy the planet. That'd be a Klingon approach.
Yes. But, you know, destroying the planet and murdering children is not something that we endorse here on the Battle Bridge.
No. No, we don't. Because if we did, I'd start with my own. Sorry, Lex, I don't mean that. Anyway... although I do tell her, you're the reason why some animals eat their young. So there's one last duty to perform. Now, before we get to the last duty to perform, do you have anything to add about what we've talked about?
No, I'm pretty much done on my side.
Okay. This one last duty to perform. Okay. Call me an old sentimental dog, but okay, the destruction of the Langtree. Here's Pulaski's log about the event. Quote, "Scientists believe no experiment is a failure, but even a mistake advances the evolution of understanding. But achievement has a price. For one brief glimpse of the mysterious blueprint of human evolution, the men and women of the USS Langtree paid with their lives. Their sacrifice is thus noted in this scientist's log." And so then we have, as she is giving this log, different commands are being done. You know, arm the torpedoes. And then at the end, you know, gentlemen, they all get up. The back of the bridge crew turn around, and they all stand at attention while they destroy the USS Langtree. Now, I'm gonna talk a little bit more about that in a second, but I thought that was quite moving. Didn't you?
I do. And I actually think that it's, I mean, I'm afraid we're rolling back to, you know, the appropriate and sensible Picard here. I think that all of this is really as and how you should act. I thought that it was very, very touching, and I actually also agree 100% with Pulaski's sentiment here. Mm-hmm. I think that as long as it's an honest experiment that has gone wrong and it has highlighted things and it wasn't done in a reckless manner, it is absolutely. I think she's absolutely on the ball here.
Although it's very interesting why they would try to create advanced human beings considering what happened with Khan. And yeah. Like you said, we get into this more in Deep Space Nine with the genetic engineering that... I'll tell you something. If you and I do Deep Space Nine, you're going to have a very bitter co-host at the time after they do this whole genetic thing and his father gets put in jail for however many months or years. You're going to have a fairly bitter co-host every time they mention his genetic engineering. It actually irritated the hell out of me. So wait till you get to those. What's that going to be, about 3 or 4 years from now?
it's season is it season six?
I think it was five or six. It was 5 or 6. I don't know. And you know, we've been talking for long enough that we can't really get into it. But I'm just saying, just wait. Okay. So anything else?
No, nothing for me. So it's now time for our final thoughts and ratings on this episode. Giving it a score from 1 to 5, 1 being the worst, and obviously 5 being the best. Now, actually, I'm going to go first here. I actually really enjoy this episode. I think it's a very good episode. I'm not going to say it's a very good episode. I think it's a good episode. I don't think it's a very good episode. I think there are some things that don't quite work. I don't think the story is quite deep enough to make it like an excellent episode. But for what it is on paper, which is a Pulaski-centric episode, I enjoyed myself a lot more than I thought I was going to. I think that, you know, there are a few nitpicks here and there about, you know, sensible Picard this week and reckless Picard all the other weeks that we've seen him. And there is a scientific nitpick that I threw up about the DNA reversal shouldn't have really unaged Pulaski. But all of that aside, I thought, you know, this is a nice kind of a mystery. I think it's well paced. I think that it kind of keeps you going in terms of a bit of a mystery about where this is coming from. And I really did quite enjoy this week. I don't think it has a deep message. And I think all truly great Star Trek episodes kind of need a good message. And also, it was a little bit thin in terms of there's no underlined B line storyline other than just Pulaski and Picard being at each other's throats. I think when all is said and done, and very similar to last week when it's somewhere between the 3 and 4, once again, I'm coming down on the 3 for this episode. I think it's a solid, it's a solid, good episode of Trek. So, Lou, you're going to surprise me, I expect.
Yes, actually, I am. You mentioned the deep message. Actually, I kind of believe there is kind of a message in here, and it's don't mess with genetic DNA or cloning. I bet you I felt it was a stab at that cloning because it was kind of a wasn't Dahlia the Sheep cloned around that time, and then all of a sudden the whole hype of cloning humans and embryos and STEM research, it's pretty much when it all seemed to have developed. So I think there kind of is a message, but I could be so wrong on that. I never even considered it until you said something about a deep message. I'm coming at this from a layman's perspective, whereas you're coming at this from a scientific perspective. So you say it's, you know, is it a very good episode versus a good episode? Give me a minute for that. The previous six writers of this should actually be ashamed of themselves. This time, they finally write an episode where I not only respect Pulaski, I'm rooting for her the entire time. While she comes off as a B word at times, she took chances in the name of science and almost paid for it with her own life. I thought Pulaski was the star of this episode. I don't know if Beverly Crusher could have done things differently, let alone better, but Pulaski knocks this ball way out of the park. So, I bang on Pulaski. Not today. We'll go back to that next week. So, is this a very good episode? As a layman who doesn't know science or whether anything is a possibility, I liked the ride. I thought it was a brilliant episode. I was great for this ride. I like what they were trying to do, and in the end, I found myself all choked up as the bridge crew rises to attention to pay its final respects to the Langtree. I know it's not a real ship. There are no real people on that unreal ship, but it's still moving to watch its final seconds. So when a show can do that, I'd say it earns respect. While it was a very good episode for me, perhaps even just great, you guys are now saying, aha, here's one of his fives. No, it's not quite one of the fives. As you say, there are some plot lines. The hair follicle with the live cells was a way to just wrap up this story. It doesn't sound plausible or believable, but hey, I'm good for it. So, in my opinion, I thought about giving this a 4, but really, because of Pulaski, crazy, I do believe in halves, so I am going for a 4.5. This is very close, but it wasn't a 5 to me. So, now, oh yeah, and like I said, I wonder what happened to the medical courier they were supposed to rendezvous with at Star Station India. Because their presence was imperative, but obviously we don't know what was done. So yes, did I shock you? 4.5.
I actually think that season 2's been better than I remember it was, mm-hmm. as we've gone through it, with the exception of the outrageous Okona. I think there's been a lot of solid stuff, and you know, I've come down. I ended up thinking that the Chard was better than I remembered. I enjoyed West Science's Lease. Elementary Dear Data and I think Loud as a Whisper both got 4s from me for being good, you know, very good episodes. The last two that we've had, they've been solid. They've been above average. I didn't think they've quite, you know, broken through to what I would consider to be very good, but we're certainly not seeing any duds here. Like, we unfortunately saw a couple of like missteps and trip-ups in Season 1. I don't know. You know, I haven't given it enough thought to fully understand where it is coming from. Whether it's you know, either a new writing staff or a new refocus of the direction. But I'm actually enjoying this more than I thought. And actually, just looking up at the upcoming schedule, we've got A Matter of Honor and Measure of a Man next. This is going to be fine for the next couple of weeks, right?
Oh yeah, I think we will have some good ones here. I don't know about Wesley falling in love.
Yeah, that's the next one that kind of falls out. But then after that,
Contagion.
Contagion's great.
And the Royale, you know, I like the Royale. The casino aspect of the Royale, the story was kind of silly, but I love the casino. I don't know about you. You ever go to a casino?
Never been to a casino, but I actually think it's... I like the episode. Looking ahead, the only ones that I'm fearful for is the Dauphin and Up the Long Ladder. And I know everyone will say, oh, Shades of Grey is also in Season 2. It doesn't bother me that, you know, they had to make a clip show in order to make up the numbers. You know, this was writer's strike year. You know, they had to deliver X episodes. If they couldn't deliver X, they had to deliver X minus one. And I, in my opinion, what they do with what they do in order to get out of actually having to produce an episode is fine. I'm not too much of a hater on that.
Empress Worf would say, I project it. I'm not giving the score completely, but I'm projecting like a 1.5 for me. But okay. Anyway.
Oh no, sure. I mean, Barry, I don't think it's a great episode. I just don't have. I wouldn't have hatred towards it in a way that. Sometimes the most frustrating episodes are the ones that try and then kind of fall flat. I just don't think Shades of Grey, they try.
No.
So they get a pass.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm surprised the network didn't like cancel the show because of that. This is our cliffhanger. Anyway, okay.
Next time on Star Trek The Next Generation.
I've been assigned to serve this ship and to obey your orders.
Commander Riker joins the Klingons. And is faced with a deadly decision.
I intend to attack the Enterprise and destroy it.
He must battle his own crew to survive.
I order you to lower your shields and surrender.
Prepare to attack!
On Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Well, join us next week as we review Season 2, Episode 8, A Matter of Honor. And we are slated to have Mark Stamper on. So, I've been Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm James from London.
Take care and good night.
Good night, everybody.